After this, Absalom, the son of David, had a lovely sister, whose name was Tamar. And Amnon, the son of David, loved her. Amnon was so distressed over his sister Tamar, that he became sick, for she was a virgin. And it was improper for Amnon to do anything to her. But Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother. Now Jonadab was a very crafty man, and he said to him, "Why are you, the king's son, becoming thinner day after day? Will you not tell me?" Amnon said to him, "I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." So Jonadab said to him, "Lie down on your bed and pretend to be ill. And when your father comes to see you, say to him, 'Please let my sister Tamar come and give me food and prepare the food in my sight, that I may see it and eat from her hand.'" Then Amnon lay down and pretended to be ill. And when the king came to see him, Amnon said to the king, "Please let Tamar, my sister, come and make a couple of cakes for me in my sight, that I may eat from her hand." And David sent her home to Tamar, saying, "Now go to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food for him." So Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house, and he was lying down. Then she took flour and kneaded it, made cakes in his sight, and baked the cakes. And she took the pan and placed them out before him, but he refused to eat. Then Amnon said, "Have everyone go out from me." And they all went out from him. Then Amnon said to Tamar, "Bring the food into the bedroom, that I may eat from your hand." And Tamar took the cakes which she had made and brought them to Amnon, her brother, in the bedroom. Now when she had brought them to him to eat, he took hold of her and said to her, "Come, lie with me, my sister." But she answered him, "No, my brother, do not force me, for no such thing should be done in Israel. Do not do this disgraceful thing. And I, where could I take my shame? And as for you, you would be like one of the fools of Israel. Now therefore, please speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you." However, he would not heed her voice, and being stronger than she, he forced her and lay with her. Then Amnon hated her exceedingly, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. And Amnon said to her, "Arise, begone." So she said to him, "No, indeed, this evil of sending me away is worse than the other that you did to me." But he would not listen to her. Then he called his servant who attended him and said, "Here, put this woman out, away from me, and bolt the door behind her." Now she had on a robe of many colors, for the king's virgin daughters wore such apparel. And his servant put her out and bolted the door behind her. Then Tamar put ashes on her head and tore her robe of many colors that was on her, and laid her hand on her head and went away crying bitterly. And Absalom, her brother, said to her, "Has Amnon, your brother, been with you? But now hold your peace, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this thing to heart." So Tamar remained desolate in her brother Absalom's house. But when King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. And Absalom spoke to his brother Amnon, neither good nor bad. For Absalom hated Amnon because he had forced his sister Tamar. And it came to pass, after 2 full years, that Absalom had sheep shearers in Baal Hazor, which is near Ephraim. So Absalom invited all the king's sons. Then Absalom came to the king and said, "Kindly note, your servant has sheep shearers. Please let the king and his servants go with your servant." But the king said to Absalom, "No, my son, let us not all go now, lest we be a burden to you." Then he urged him, but he would not go, and he blessed him. Then Absalom said, "If not, please let my brother Amnon go with us." And the king said to him, "Why should he go with you?" But Absalom urged him, so he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. Now Absalom had commanded his servants, saying, Watch now when Amnon's heart is merry with wine. And when I say to you, Strike Amnon, then kill him. Do not be afraid. Have I not commanded you? Be courageous and valiant. So the servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose, and each one got on his mule and fled. And it came to pass, while they were on the way, that news came to David, saying, Absalom has killed all the king's sons, and not one of them is left. So the king arose and tore his garments and lay on the ground, and all his servants stood by with their clothes torn. Then Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, asked and said, Let not my lord suppose they have killed all the young men, the king's sons, for only Amnon is dead. For by the command of Absalom this has been determined from the day that he forced his sister Tamar. Now therefore, let not my lord the king take the thing to his heart, to think that all the king's sons are dead, for only Amnon is dead. Then Absalom fled, and the young man who was keeping watch lifted his eyes and looked, and there many people were coming from the road on the hillside behind him. And Jonadab said to the king, Look, the king's sons are coming. As your servant said, so it is. So it was, as soon as he had finished speaking, that the king's sons indeed came, and they lifted up their voice and wept. Also the king and all the servants wept very bitterly. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, king of Geshur, and David mourned for his son every day. So Absalom fled and went to Geshur, and was there 3 years. And King David longed to go to Absalom, for he had been comforted concerning Amnon, because he was dead.
Thank you, Dave. That was 2 Samuel chapter 13. As you know, we've been going through this series of Samuel, all the way out from Joshua onward. Before I go into my commentary, this, as I mentioned when I started out, this is a very full chapter. There's a lot of stuff hidden here. Not very much of it we'll cover today. We'll cover about half of it if I can, depending on if we have any divergent topics, as we normally seem to bird box happen. But before I go into my little spiel, are there comments, questions, things you saw that, wait, why is that the case? What happened here? What was going on there? This, of course, is a continuation of the prophecy that Nathan pronounced upon David, which David, of course, prophesied his own punishment during the story of the man with the multiple sheep and then the one guy with only one sheep, that David would pay four times what he gave. Well, he took one man's wife and took his life, so David loses all of his wives and loses four of his sons. Four times the fee. And David pronounced the judgment. And it happens to match the Torah's command that if you steal something, you pay four times. So David just kind of carried it through. So this is a continuation of that. Obviously, we have the sword would never leave David's house, and here it is, the story of Absalom and Amnon, as well as Tamar. So any questions or comments that you'd like to start out with? John, go ahead.
In the modern vernacular, you know, we have that expression, when you play, you pay.
Yeah.
And with regard to sexual sins, it's true more than anything else. The fallout for sexual sin is usually greater than some of the other stuff we do. Not necessarily always, but generally speaking, it is. Especially with regard to adultery and stuff like that. But here we see Amnon pay with his very own life for his shenanigans, you know. And so, you know, obviously it's a fulfillment, like you said, for what was put on David for his shenanigans.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see this ugly continuity that when you play, you do pay.
You do. It's a beautiful lesson on the surface, as far as what you read, the actual text. All right, well, it says this is what happened. Clearly, this is a very, very bad thing. Don't do it, or it may happen to you kind of idea, which is a great lesson to always remember. This is important things. Certain things you just don't do. Here's an example of one you just don't do. The consequences are so great, it's not, believe me, it's not worth, yeah, not anyway. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Pat.
The fact that he loved her and then hated her after he violated
right.
her, there is a principle there that many times you see it even in life today. When somebody violates a person, they hate that person, then you see it, you know, when a rapist will oftentimes kill his victim rather than himself, and you see that played out in many ways, that the person who has violated the person hates that person rather than himself and will become violent toward them.
It's very common. You're absolutely right. The emotion quickly changes. I'm not a psychologist. I couldn't explain all the details of what happens inside a person's mind that way, but it does quickly change from love to intense hatred. Yes, David.
The word better used would be infatuation.
For what he had.
For what he had. And he worked himself up in such a tizzy, if you will, over this young woman that, you know, his whole life, his whole core came out of balance with this thing. And then when it finally happened, he was obviously disgusted with it and wasn't everything that he had hoped for. And it turned. If he truly loved her, he would have gone through the proper channels to marry her, and if it were permissible to even do so under those conditions of family, if it was true love. But it was really infatuation, a lustful infatuation.
Which is one of the more dangerous types of desire. Any other comments? Well, we're going to go ahead and get into this. This, as I mentioned before, this is a very complex, very full chapter. As you notice on my board here, I've written in three columns. There's Adam and Eve, David, and I shortened her name, Bathsheba. She has a long name, forgive me. And Amnon and Tamar. These are nothing more than most, but not all, of the similarities between these two stories. Three stories. These three stories are, we call, thematically tied. I mean that God is trying to tell you the same lesson in all three stories. And he's repeating it for you. And in this case, with Absalom, what Absalom does as a result of it, a God is giving you an answer at the end of the third story as the solution to this problem. I'm going to go through these very, very briefly right now. We'll go through more detail probably next time up here when I get to discuss some of the more hidden topics and word phrases in this chapter. But first, all three stories have these basic similarities. They're all tempted by what? Well, in Adam, either tempted with a woman, meaning Adam is tempted with, there's a woman involved in temptation. David and Bathsheba, Anna and Tamar, they're both tempted by a woman. There's a similarity. It's just these, by the way, thematic similarities are not identical to each other. It means that there are symbols showing up repeatedly. That's the thematic concept. Is it that the symbol or the idea is showing up? So yes, the temptation that shows up for all three in the form of a woman involved with it. Granted, Eve is part of the temptation for Adam that she hands to him. Adam never sees the serpent, by the way. He just receives whatever Eve gives to him. Three stories, both parties sin together as a unit, not individually. All three stories, there's a judgment pronounced. In the case of Adam and Eve, God gives a judgment. In the case of David and Bathsheba, God gives a judgment. In the case of Amnon and Tamar, Absalom gives a judgment. This is important. Why it changes from God, Absalom. Because in this story, Absalom was just introduced as the Messiah. So it's important. God is doing that both in the story patterns here, but also in verse, I think it's 20, verse 20. He is introduced as Messiah, meaning a messianic figure, not the Messiah. There's a messianic figure. So it's important why it's done that way. All three have a separation or banishment involved. In the case of Adam and Eve, they're banished from the garden. In the case of David and Bathsheba, they're separated or banished from their child, which they had together, the one thing that unified them together, which is Adam and Eve, of course, that Eden unified the two of them, the child unified Bathsheba and David. And in this case, it was Amnon's lust that unified Amnon and Tamar. but they're both banished. Now, in this case, in Tamar's case, not that Anna was banished, but she was banished from him. In the form of they locked the door behind it, get out. So there was a banishment in all three stories. You also have, in Adam and Eve, an angel is posted to prevent reentry into the unification, reentry into this place of safe haven known as Eden. Well, in David and Bathsheba's case, death is what prevents them from reunifying to their child. As David points out, the child will not come back to me. I will be going to him, but he will not come to me. There's no sense in mourning any further. So David is acknowledging there is a locked door I cannot pass. The child cannot come back through again. And in Anna's case, of course, the servant literally locks the door. So all three cases, there's a separation involved with the fallout through this sin. In the case, following up with that, Adam and Eve's case, because Adam and Eve introduced death and sin, Cain, obviously, subsequent story, kills Abel. The introduction of sin and desire to be with God. In the case of David and Bathsheba, David kills Uriah. In the case of Amnon and Tamar, Absalom kills Amnon. You see the pattern that's showing up here? There's a lot of similarities. There are some differences, don't get me wrong, but there are a lot of similarities. And the case following up with that is that Cain, of course, is banished. David, we don't have David being banished, per se. He's banished from never building God's house. That is his form of banishment, not from necessarily from people, but from God he was separated out. So there is a form of banishment as a fallout for David, too. Did God call him, you are too bloody. You have Uriah's blood on your hands. So in the form of David was banished as well. But Cain gets banished, David sort of gets banished, and Absalom, of course, is banished. All three of them continue on the same thematic story. Now, in David and Bathsheba, David, Bathsheba, and Amnon Tamar, both stories involve, of course, a beautiful woman, which, based on the similarities so far, I'm guessing Eve was probably rather attractive as well. they're both involved, for David Tamar, Amnon Tamar and David Bathsheba, they're both involved a forbidden relationship, versus Adam and Eve was a forbidden act. Some similarities, but a little bit different. This is a sexual relationship or desire that is forbidden. Because both Tamar was obviously his biological half-sister, and the Torah does forbid that. So as David pointed out, whether it be permissible, it technically is not permissible. So would David have offered her? I'm not going to predict what David would or wouldn't have done. The Torah would not have advocated such a thing. Forbidden relationships, as far as similarities between David and Bathsheba and Amnon and Tamar, and they also, of course, in the cases of Adam, Eve, and Amnon Tamar, the woman is the one who is deceived initially. She's the one who's being lied to start out with. Now, based on that idea, is it possible that Bathsheba was being deceived by David? Very possible. Do we know that? No. But it's possible. As Daryl asked me a few weeks ago, how emphatic was Bathsheba's no? Well, based on Tamar's emphatic no, and the deception that happened to Eve, I'd say reasonably emphatic. How deceived she was, I can't say for certain how the intensity or how David manipulated her one way or the other, but it was enough to where there was some deception going on. So we see a lot of similarities, all right? As Jeff once said, it's kind of like the icon on your desktop. It's a print button. When God pushes the button, he expects something to happen. It's always supposed to be the same thing. God printed Adam and Eve's story of the sin and transgression that happened then. He said, oh, here's David and Bathsheba. Print, the same thing happens. Different words, a different scenario around it, but the results continue on with Amnon and Tamar. Obviously, there's differences between these two stories. We're not seeing the differences, we're seeing the similarities. Amnon and Tamar, the print button was hit again. We have similarities showing up again. These are thematically tied. Why did God wish to have these stories repeated in the Bible? That's the question. Why? What was his purpose? What was his gain by it? Clearly he did it. And by the way, these are most, but not all, the similarities. There's actually more I'll cover. Maybe not today, but there's more I will likely cover. It has to do with more similarities between Adam and Eve and Amnon and Tamar. Well, first of all, there's technique that God uses. And that when he takes a story like Adam and Eve's, and takes a story like Amnon and Tamar, and granted, these two stories have a lot of similarities, even with both regarding food. Food is turned in from a thing that you want in Amnon's story into the actual sin itself. It converts it over, which, of course, that means eating it is sin. Guess what happened with Adam and Eve? Oh, eating it was sin. So you have even more similarities. When God ties these two stories together and then ties Amnon to Tamar's to David's, that means David's is tied to Adam. It's a sequence of events. Which means what? Adam introduced death into his family, known as mankind. David introduced death into his family through this sin. Amnon is a continuation of that death. But Absalom's the key. Because unlike David and Bathsheba, which their conclusion was not positive, Adam and Eve's conclusion was not positive, Amnon and Tamar's conclusion turns out to be a positive. God's giving you a clue and setting the stage to tell you about Absalom. The story is repeated three times for a reason. It's a messianic prophecy. Absalom's banished for 3 years for a reason. It's a messianic prophecy. It's involving a death, which we already know by past history in the Torah is concerned. When you have the number three and death involved, it is pointing to the Messiah in some fashion. It's something he's going to do or he has done. So we have the similarities showing up already in the story. Well, Absalom is being set up, and he actually starts out his messianic prophecy in this chapter, even though it continues on for the next, like, five chapters. It is for his whole rebellion. It's quite a beautiful setup. But this is the beginning of it. We're introducing, or the next chapter introduces the beginning of the theistic structure, which will have a beautiful layout, hopefully, if I can type it up fast enough, which we'll see. Or, as Jeff says, just take a picture of it. But we'll see. So this is the story that we're going to be covering today. Any questions so far? Yes, Taryn.
Usually in this kind of case, the victim isn't sinning. Why is it that you said that they all, Tamar and Amnon, they sin together as a unit? How is Tamar sinning in this situation?
By being taken with an unmarried, being unmarried. That is, the actual act itself is the sin. Now, we're not discussing fault issues. As far as who is ultimately responsible, well, you know, in Adam and Eve's case, who was ultimately responsible? Was Eve responsible?
No.
No. Well, not even the serpent. Adam was responsible.
Yeah.
And David and Bathsheba's case, it was the unit was unacceptable act that both resulted in a sin because they were both married. Well, she was obviously married, and he, of course, had many wives. But who was ultimately responsible, the primary responsible party in Adam and Bathsheba's story? David. Sorry, David Bathsheba. David Bathsheba. Amnon and Tamar, the sin itself occurred between both of them. Who was primarily responsible for it? Well, yeah, Amnon was. Clearly, so we're discussing who's at fault. We're discussing the sin itself occurred, and both of them together had to do it. As opposed to, for example, if I go out and kill someone, I sinned all by myself. I didn't have a partner come do it with me. And so, as this case, the unit together is being tied to the sin. And there's a reason for that, which I'm hoping to get to today. Perhaps it was how Absalom takes care of his sister. But hopefully we'll get there. I can't say. Any other questions so far? To make sense what we've covered a little bit? You don't have to agree with me. It doesn't make a difference. I'm talking about this anyway, because it's fun. So far, so good. Okay. Oh, sorry. Period. Go ahead.
I may not be clear on my understanding of Absalom, but wasn't he caught by his hair in the branches?
Yes, that was him.
Dad? So
yes.
How does that fit with the messianic?
Oh, that is the most beautiful part of it.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay.
But I can't get there yet. That is the epitome of the messianic image right there. Because who was hanging on a tree in Messiah's time? And what was over his head? A crown of vegetation or thorns. Absalom's caught by his hair hanging on a tree, vegetation and thorns on his head. And what happens to Absalom? He is run through with swords 10 times, granted, he was very, and then beaten to death. Messiah was run through, I think, just one time, but he was also beaten to death. The similarities mount leading up to that, and that's just the culmination of it. Oh, don't get me wrong. We're doing messianic imagery, these messianic figures, not that their entire existence is Messiah. That's not. The Messiah is only the Son of God, and we only know him as Yeshua, that's it. But there are pictures that show up ahead of time to tell everybody what the Messiah is supposed to do, what he's supposed to look like. Well, in the story of Absalom and David when they're rebellion, which we're going to get to over the next few chapters, both of them are technically messianic figures at the same time. But see, you can't kill a Messiah and then have him come back again before Messiah comes back again. So how does God tell you, by the way, Messiah is going to die and come back? How do we do that? Oh, I have an idea. I'll have two Messiahs, I'll have one die. And one comes back. Absalom and David. We'll get to there, we'll get there. That's a whole other story. But that's what you point out, that is one of the more beautiful aspects of it, which it's a lot of writing. So I'll get there. I'm not a very quick writer. Okay, so let's continue on. Any other questions so far? There's more to... Oh, yes, by all means, Anne.
Wouldn't it have been David's place to judge his son?
Yes! It would have been David's place to judge his son. And he didn't. That's part of this.
He was amiss then, or...?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Oh, okay.
Completely. David should have... When he first heard with Tamar and Amnon, he said, bring Amnon to me right now. Here's a trial, if he's found guilty. Here's your execution date. Probably now is most likely. They don't have like long, there aren't appeals very often. The higher court system. That would have been normally what happened. But David, of course, purposefully does not do that. And that's part of the story. It's important that he not do it. It's important that Absalom do it. That's how he points out. That's how it points to Absalom being the Messiah.
David was deceived.
Yes, David was deceived as well. Yes, he was not leading up to it. Obviously, after the death, it wasn't much of a deception. Then, I think it's a matter of his personal choice to be deceived that Absalom didn't like Amnon. That was his, I will blind myself because that's so obvious. Anybody could see, all of David's servants knew that Absalom disliked Amnon. How could David not know? But that's a whole different story. So let's continue on here. One more connection that's important between Adam and Eve and Amnon and Tamar. Yonadab. Let's go read about what it says about Yonadab. That's in verse 3. Amnon had a close friend named Yonadab, the son of David's brother, Shimeah. And Yonadab was a very cunning man. Have you ever heard that phrase before? Where have you heard cunning? Something being cunning? Serpent was cunning, wasn't he? Cunning, he was more cunning than all the beasts of the field, as Genesis 3 puts it, for the serpent. Why? He's not the only person ever to be called cunning. Don't get me wrong. The Bible calls a couple of people cunning. But in this particular place and point in time, at the beginning of the story, the idea is to draw your attention. Something is happening between Yonadab and Amnon. Is Yonadab being the agent of the serpent? It was his idea, wasn't it? He's the one who convinced Amnon, wasn't it? He set him up. Did the serpent set up Eve? Oh, you better believe she did. Yeah, he did. Completely set up. Yeah, and get what Yonadab does at the end of the story. He says, David, not all your sons were dead, just Amnon. Because that was decided 2 years ago when he first raped Tamar, Absalom's sister. Wait a minute. If Yonadab knew that the past 2 years, why didn't he reveal that to David earlier? And say, wait a minute. By the way, Absalom wants to invite Amnon, my close friend, to a party. Absalom hasn't spoken to Amnon in 2 years because they greatly dislike one another. You think a bell would go off, wouldn't you? In Yonadab's mind, it probably did go off. That says, something bad's about to happen, and Yonadab knew it because he set it up. Did he know, or most likely know, that Absalom was going to greatly dislike this act that Amnon was going to do to his sister? Well, who wouldn't dislike this act? He knew quite well. Yonadab gave Amnon the idea, the deception, or set him up. Amnon then took it and ran with it, which is his own evil sin. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying Amnon's not fully responsible. He is. He could have said, Yonadab, that's a foolish idea. Get away from me. That's what he should have said. But he didn't. He said, I like that idea. It'll give me exactly what I want. You know, Deborah just obliged him. But the point is, a cunning individual shows up and gives a deception or an idea to deceive. And what's the whole point? His whole thing, oh, pretend you're sick and say, oh, well, I will only feel better if Tamar comes and helps. More lies, more deception involved. If Tamar comes and cooks for me, and then I'll feel better because, you know, seeing her cook might help me develop an appetite and I'll get hungry then, kind of idea. So he set this thing up not only to deceive, it's all full of deception in itself. And Anna, of course, was a willing, more than willing participant. So we're set up with, we're already being told, pay attention to Adam and Eve, because we're going to have a repeat. So God starts out with that, tells you ahead of time. We have a cunning individual here who's setting the stage of something very, very bad to happen. That's what we have. So, of course, as he goes through, he fakes the sickness. Now, in Amnon's case, which is identical to, in my opinion, Adam and Eve's, the sin that Amnon wished to do with Tamar, he wished to do in secret. What did he do when he had the opportunity? Everybody get out. We wish to be alone. I wish to conceal this. Sister, come here, into my bedroom, where no one can see us. What did Adam and Eve do when they sinned? They hid themselves, didn't they? They tried to conceal it. What did David and Bathsheba do when they sinned? They tried to hide it, cover it up, which we all do. But it's a continuation of the similarities between the stories. There's a overt, written out, planned, concealing process. Oh, well, I will do it this method so no one will know about it, and then I'll get away with it, type of idea. Of course, Adam and Eve, they're obviously discovered, and obviously quite plainly discovered, as well as, of course, David and Bathsheba, as most sins usually come out. So, of course, I already mentioned before, they're both banished. They have a lot of banishment similarities to it. What's Adam and Eve's, when they are banished, another similarity between Adam and Tamar and Adam and Eve, when they are banished, what does God do for them? He makes them a clothing. What kind of clothing?
Skin clothing.
What animal was it? Well, when you sin, it has to be a clean animal, most likely, to pay for the sin. Could it have been a sheep? Could have been. Oh, look, what's Tamar wearing? Oh, a fine wool tunic. It's a woolen tunic. They both, God made a tunic for Adam and Eve. Oh, Tamar has a tunic. God, Adam and Eve's tunic, of course, made out of wool, most likely, or maybe not, but it could have been wool. Tamar is wool tunic. That's what the daughters wore. It's a colorful wool tunic. What does she do when she has to leave or she's banished or kicked out? Well, she tears her tunic. She's now separated. She's no longer identified as being clean anymore or holy. Well, when you're wearing an animal skin, what does that usually mean? It means the animal died. Because they don't usually get their skin up willingly still being alive. So you're wearing something that is dead. So in Adam and Eve's case, they're also wearing a dead thing. They're no longer clean. Now, Tamar, of course, puts ashes or dust upon her head. That, I believe, is for a different reason, but than what may have been commonly understood. Because in my text, it's not actually technically ashes, it's actually dirt. Dirt has been put on my head. Well, she put it on her head. What was the pronouncement of judgment between Adam and Eve and what she must do that seems very similar to putting dirt on your head for Tamar? Adam works the ground, and who's in charge of Eve? Adam. Actually, God commands your head will be, dirt will be your head. That's what he's saying, because Adam means dirt. Dirt will be your head. Look what Tamar does. Oh, I'm ashamed. Dirt is on my head. It's a beautiful, look at the symbolism. Wow, look what God did. It's brilliant. So he's repeating the story again. Obviously, she doesn't have a person standing on her head, but the point is that the words themselves, the wordplay, the story between them is being repeated for us to pay attention to catch and spot. Ooh, an important event is happening here. Let's read closely. Let's read carefully and get as much as we can out of it. So let's continue on. She, of course, runs with her head, hands over head covered because she's been shamed. She's no longer a virgin, and she's also not married. Two things you don't do, especially the king's daughter. That's really, really, really bad. Looks bad on the king. So what does she do? Her savior comes. Absalom. Absalom saves her. What does he do? Now, granted, Could she have run to her father, King David? Maybe, maybe not. Who was she supposed to run to? What's the Torah say? The closest male relative who is over you. A brother, an older brother. Preferably older brother, the firstborn brother. Could she have run to David? Yeah, technically. Would that have accomplished anything? Well, let's see. How many children does he have? Who counts? He's got more sons and daughters. How many wives does he have? I forgot. 8, 10, whatever. Is he going to be really... please come, my daughter. You will be protected from Absalom. Oh, by the way, he sits right here. Because he's crown prince. I'll protect you from him. Yeah, good luck. He's right there. Absalom is the crown prince. David's not going to protect her from Absalom. You can't do it. It's not going to... Amnon. Keep the words mixed up. Not going to protect her from Amnon, the crown prince. So who does she run to? The next closest male relative who is technically in charge of her, because she's not married, is her brother, Absalom. And what does she do when she gets there? Changed clothes. She no longer has her head covered. Because she is now covered by her brother. That's how it works. She is shamed as long as she has no covering. Well, her cover, as long as her head's covered. She's shamed because of what has happened to her. Well, once she's now covered by Absalom, her shame is concealed or no longer seen. It's considered no longer a fact. Now, Absalom, of course, as it records a few chapters now, has this beautiful daughter called Tamar. Well, isn't that coincidental? Because when that happens, what does Tamar become? When she runs to Absalom and he is her caretaker, what does she become? A daughter to him. That's what she becomes. And then, chapter 14, he has a daughter named Tamar. How did he get a daughter named Tamar? She's very beautiful. Why? Because it's a sister. She became his daughter. She is now under his control, his household, as a child will be. And as an older brother, she's already been shamed. She can't be married again. She is taken care of until she dies by him and his household. That's the beginning of how he becomes a Messiah figure. He now takes the ones who have been shamed and cursed and trashed or tarnished. You are now covered. You are now cleaned. You don't have to have ash on your head anymore. We'll change your clothes, give you a new robe, clean you up a little bit. You are now my child. He does more than that. What's our Messiah supposed to do for the one that is so cunning, deceives us all, and entraps us all? He's supposed to rescue us. He's supposed to kill him, isn't he? Isn't our Messiah supposed to kill the one who deceives us? The ultimate deceiver, that's his function, that's Messiah's function. What does Absalom do? Oh, look. He kills the one who deceived her, Tamar. And again, another messianic imagery. This is just the beginning of Absalom's messianic imagery. I won't go through all this chapter because it's a little bit too much to go through all of it. I'm out of time. continuing on, just to the tail end of the tag, one more thing before I have to call it quits because I don't have time to tell you about the food thing because it's quite fascinating to watch how it transitions. But in Absalom's case, as he flees, how long is he banished for?
Three
years. How long is Messiah dead? Oh, yeah, three days. Oh, look, number three shows up. It's a separation of what? Between Absalom and David, the king. What's the separation between Messiah? Well, Messiah's death, he's separated from God, the king, for 3 days. You have the separation occurs there. That it's symbolic. It's put there for a reason, so you just spot it. We're having themes are going to start showing up much more liberally, as God writes, in 14 and on through chapter 20. I apologize. You know what? No, I'm going to finish this one thing. It doesn't take very long, because this is just silly to stop right there. Go back a little bit. In verse 5, I've told you a couple of times about chiastic structures, right? Similarities between stories. Something's repeated again and again and again and again and again. And the objective is for you to spot the differences between stories or a turning point. Something that's, the story goes, point A, B, 3, C, through all of that. Oh, now it starts reversing itself, coming back again. As you read the story, that's the two basic types of structures. Well, chapter 13 has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, six, seven chiasm structures in itself. They're designed to repeat themselves again and again and again, and the objective is for you to spot the differences, because the differences tells you the story, tells you the purpose, the goal, the objective that God's trying to tell you about. Now, because each of these, God so kindly wrote it in verse form, meaning somebody else wrote it down, and it happened to break it up this way. Verse 5 is a chiasm structure of verse 6, which is also one of verse 7, and one of verse 8, verse 9, 10, and 11. These are each their own chiasm structures. Now, each one drops or alters the information slightly as they go through. But there's one thing that changes I want to catch your attention to. In verse 5, we'll just start out here. What is the plan? Well, you'll feign illness, okay? The king will come to visit. Your sister Tamar to serve food, and she'll prepare a light meal in my sight, and I may eat from her hand. Those are the basic, five items I have in verse 5. Verse 6, what happens? It repeats. He feigns illness, the king comes to visit him, sister Tamar to prepare food, in this case two dumplings or two biscuits, in my sight, they may eat from her hand. Basically a complete duplicate of itself. Well, that makes sense. The story just repeats it. It's supposed to be the plan, and here it works. When I was in verse 7, David, instead of comes, where we're dropping the feigned illness, instead of comes, he sends someone, Tamar in this case, to Amnon, so that, and by the way, sends it to Amnon's house, hence he can now see her, as it points out, sister, so he may prepare in my sight. So that's a similarity. To prepare a meal for him to eat. That's the intention. So we have certain similarities, a repetition of the ideas, the same basic thing. Tamar's going to Amnon's house to prepare a meal for him to eat. That's the basic similarities that are going on here. Verse 8. Tamar, this repeats it. Go went to Amnon's house. Instead of come, sent, now went to Amnon's house. Where he's lying down. Well, yeah, he's feigning illness. Okay, illness comes back. She prepares a meal in his sight, a light meal, for him to eat. The basic principles, they're very similar on their structural integrity, as far as the themes are being duplicated itself. There are a few changes as it moves along. There's one change that happens in verse 11 that's key. Verse 9. She tries to serve him meal for him to eat. She tries to serve it to him. Of course, he refuses to eat. Now, at that point, we drop the went to his house. We drop the lying down, meaning he's no longer sick anymore. Serves him to eat. So God's trying to draw your attention to serving him to eat. Because that's the part that's being repeated all the time in these chiastic structure, very short chiastic structures. Verse 10, she serves a meal. Of course, the objective, of course, for him to eat from her hand. So we have the serving the meal for him to eat from her hand. That seems the consistent idea going through all these verses. What changes is in verse 11. She tries to serve the meal, and what does he eat? Her. She was the meal. She was the thing to be eaten. Not physically. The whole point is that he's taking her. So what's the similarities? Well, we have a lot of things being dropped on all these verses we're going through it. But one thing stayed pretty consistent through all of them until now. Her serving the meal and him eating was always pretty consistent through all of them. There's the parallels. There's your matches. But then at the very end, she serves and he takes her. So what's God telling you in this story? I don't have my marker. I lost my marker. Oh, here it is. Thank you. Yeah, be careful here. And it's telling you, let's see, where is it here? Did I even write it up? They completely forgot to write it. Well, anyway, I'll write it up top. Adam and Eve, eating equaled sin. Amon and Tamar, what is this chiastic structure telling you? Eating equals sin. That's what God's doing with the chiastic structure built inside this chapter. Now, granted, this isn't a nice, pretty, clean chiastic structure. It's a dirty one, but it's very apparent. You can see the repetition happening. And the one repetition that changes the most. The other things were dropped. We're not seeing the thing that dropped. So that actually changes what matters. Dropping things is okay. Who cares? When something changed what you draw attention to. What changed was eating for Amnon and Tamar became sin. They're sinning. That was the objective. That's what God's telling you or teaching you. So eating is sin. Well, do we ever know that? Well, in Adam and Eve's case, we knew that eating was sin. That was quite obvious. When did sin show up with Adam and Eve? When did the temptation show up? Was it early on in the story? Were they living there for a while? We don't know the exact timing, it doesn't matter. When did the devil, if you use that term, plan on Adam and Eve sinning with food? Probably the very beginning. When did Amnon and Jonadab plan on sinning with food? The very beginning. The beginning of the story is the story. The beginning of it. That was the plan all along with the devil or the cunning individual or Amnon's story. That was his intention. To sin all along. The sin was in your heart from the very beginning, Amnon. The sin was in the serpent and Adam and Eve from the very beginning, Adam and Eve. You always desired this. That was your plan all along. Which of course brings, was that God's plan? Another chicken and egg question. Ellie.
Since God said that Satan would become the serpent and eat dirt all his life, it looks like he ate all four of them for
dinner. Yes, he did. Ate all four of them. Well, tomorrow's question. Yeah, he took her too. So all six, he ate them all. He ate them all. Any questions? I know there's a lot to throw at you all at once, but the similarities were important to me because I see them, and I thought they were very valuable because I'm going to introduce a lot more stuff about Absalom that isn't commonly liked. I didn't write it. I didn't introduce it. I'm not that smart. Other people are smarter than me who I'm telling you about. But they've written most of the stuff down, and I'm just kind of trying to make it in words that make sense in an hour format. But the storyline, as you can tell, even the eating and the food becoming sin is also another thematic tie, another connection between Adam and Eve. It's a beautiful story. Tragic, but beautiful. The fall of man was tragic too. The only few things I had to say about this probably won't matter today, so I'll have to do it sometime next time I'm up here. Any other questions? Anything I can answer or things that you see? Yes, Pete.
I just want to tie this into to Yeshua's teaching, our Lord. He said that anyone who believes on me consumes me. Whoever, we're consuming either wickedness or goodness. So when we're not necessarily eating his flesh.
Of course.
We're consuming belief is consuming. Faith is consuming.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful, Ty. You're absolutely right. That's another connection that you can point out, that God himself or Messiah himself pointed out. You believe me, you eat me. Similarity, you have yet another tie.
Brilliant. I've never seen the
thematic ties. Well, thematic ties are interesting. They tell you more information.
Not the ties themselves, but this particular.
Well, they're, really? I think this one's interesting. I think it's fascinating that, Well, there's other stories, too, in this chapter, but I won't cover all of them because it takes too long. And I'm totally out of time 15 minutes ago. So, have a wonderful rest of the Shabbat.